Forget Wall Street.
Today, the business focus is on Cupertino, California, and Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith in New York, in for Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, August 25th.
Coming up, what's next for Apple as CEO Steve Jobs announces his resignation?
Also, what does a steep drop in the price of gold have to do with the meeting in Wyoming?
And one earthquake is all a certain piece of glass could take.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The news last night that Apple's CEO Steve Jobs is resigning wasn't completely unexpected. Jobs is a pancreatic cancer survivor, and he had a liver transplant back in 2009. But the resignation is still probably the biggest thing to shake the tech world since, I don't know, Stacey, the iPad?
Well,
For more on this, let's bring in our Silicon Valley correspondent, Steve Henn. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Steve, let's first talk about the legacy of Steve Jobs.
You know, Jeremy, there may not be enough time to cover it. You know, this is one of the handful of people who helped bring computers into all of our homes. And more recently, he put, you know, really powerful computers in our pockets with the iPhone. But, you know, he was also the executive producer of Toy Story. So his legacy is enormous. But it's important to remember he's not gone. He's still the chairman of Apple. So who's to say his legacy is complete?
Well, what does this mean then for the future of Apple?
Well, most people I've talked to said immediately not a whole lot. Tim Cook was named the permanent CEO of Apple. He had that role for the last 8 months as the acting CEO. And he has been at Apple for a long time. He revamped their supply chain, is known as an incredibly efficient hard worker, sort of the guy around the company who makes the trains run on time. So how the markets react is obviously a big question. I asked Molly Wood, executive editor at CNET, about Cook.
He is definitely someone that Wall Street is familiar with, that shareholders feel comfortable with. He's a guy who's more than capable of kind of carrying out Steve Jobs' vision in the near future.
That seems like a pretty key phrase, in the near future.
It is. I mean, you know, Tim Cook is not the kind of person you think of necessarily when you think of the next great Apple visionary.
So a guy that makes the trains run on time, but not necessarily the next great Apple visionary, that sounds like a problem to me, Steve.
Maybe, but it's important to remember Steve Jobs didn't create every product Apple ever made by himself in his garage. You know, for years when Jobs was asked about his greatest or most underappreciated contributions as an executive, he'd say some variation of the same thing, which was that his most important role was to find the best people in the world at what he was trying to do, convince them to come work with him, and then convince them to stay and do the best work of their lives. You know, today, Apple has lots of visionaries working there. I think Cook's biggest challenge may be convincing them all to stay and then making tough calls about which visions of the future to bet on.
Marketplace's Steve Henn in Silicon Valley. Thank you so much, Steve.
Sure thing.
Well, Apple is one company that has definitely changed the way we live. For more on that, let's bring in Walt Mossberg. He's the personal technology columnist at the Wall Street Journal. Good morning, Walt.
Good morning.
Walt, Apple and Apple products have become so much a part of all of our lives. What do you think Jobs' legacy is?
I think people are lucky if they can make one major change in the world or in the way people live. And Steve Jobs, he has a legacy where he changed the way people lived and the way technology works multiple times, again and again and again. And that makes him, in my mind, a truly historic figure.
Well, most of us know Steve Jobs from what we've seen on television. Obviously, he's a visionary and quite charismatic. You know him personally. What is he like in person?
Well, he can be prickly. He is very passionate about what he believes, but he's also willing to listen. And I think the most interesting thing about him is he thinks long term. He recently disclosed that the iPad actually was developed before the iPhone, but he decided to put it on the shelf because he thought a phone was the right thing to do first. He makes products for the actual users of the products, and that's a big legacy of Steve Jobs.
Well, it's certainly paid off. Apple surpassed Exxon as the most valuable public company earlier this month, and I think had more money at one point than the U.S. Treasury, although that might not be the bar that it once was. But, you know, it really did pay off monetarily.
It has paid off monetarily, but I also think they've been the most influential technology company now for at least a decade, and they have influenced every other company in the technology space. And to me, personally, that is a more important thing than the fact that their market cap is now higher than any technology company and almost as high as Exxon's.
Walt Mossberg is personal technology columnist at The Wall Street Journal. Walt, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So what was it like on the inside of Apple under the leadership of Steve Jobs? For that part of the story, we turn to Reed Martin. He was a product designer at the company from 2003 to 2008, and he's with us now from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Good morning.
Good morning.
You've interacted personally with Steve Jobs a number of times over the years. Give us a sense of what he's like in person.
You know, in person, I think I was always struck by the sort of presence that he commanded in a room. He had an ability to sort of glance around a room and immediately know everybody's reactions to what he was saying. If you had a great reason why you disagreed with him, he would put his trust into you to know something more about that than he might know in general. If you didn't know what you were talking about, then you are going to be quickly trampled over.
Do you remember a specific instance of that?
My first experience with him, actually, I was sitting on a couch right next to him about to show him a demo, and my heart was racing. You know, he was sort of a rock star to me. He grabbed the demo from me, and he says, "I love this," and then proceeds to sort of rip it apart. And there were a couple times where, you know, he said something that I definitely thought was incorrect. I didn't, you know, have the courage to speak up, but he noticed that I wasn't reacting positively, so he turned to me. And he conceded and said, "You clearly know more about this than I do. Let's go with that."
Let me just finally ask you, what was your thought when you heard the news that he is stepping down as CEO?
Oh, you know, my heart sank. I've known this is going to happen for a while. I think, you know, all of us have. But I think he'll continue to sort of lead on in inspiration and vision no matter what he ends up doing.
Reed Martin was a designer for Apple from 2003 to 2008. Reed, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
And we've got an illustrated history of Apple, its products, and its stock price at marketplace.org.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
We just learned that Warren Buffett's company Berkshire Hathaway is investing $5 billion in Bank of America, which has been losing stock market value.
And meanwhile, we also see this morning that gold has dropped off significantly. It's down $42 an ounce in early trading here at $1,712 an ounce after a big run-up in recent days. And that's where we'll start with Diane Swonk. She is chief economist with Mesirow Financial, and she is with us from Chicago, as she is every Thursday. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Diane, first explain why gold is dropping so much so fast.
Well, there's certainly a lot of hope pinned on Chairman Bernanke giving a speech in Jackson Hole on Friday morning to reassure investors that he's willing to pull the trigger on QE3, another round of large-scale asset purchases. And that's something that would get people feeling more confident about at least equities over hoarding cash in gold.
And would QE3, quantitative easing 3, these big bond purchases by the Fed, would QE3 look like the one that just finished QE2?
All of them actually look very different, and I would expect this one to look different as well. Not only would it have to be larger than QE2 in scale, my guess is it could include more than just Treasury bond purchases going back to mortgage-backed securities as well, and the Fed may not even tip its hat to which it's buying when. I think this is important as they're looking at all different ways to pull new rabbits from a hat. Luckily, rabbits multiply for Chairman Bernanke.
And maybe the idea here is to get people to take more risk with their money. Do you think it can work?
You know, it actually did work to the extent that it got people buying equities instead of hoarding their cash in bonds and safe assets back in last year when they started it and into 2011. The important rally in equity markets also enabled IPOs out there, and those IPOs were the few things that gave us a lot of jobs at the beginning of the year. Jobs is what we need. So there is a linkage here clearly in terms of bolstering equity prices and taking more risk, making a bet on our future in the U.S. economy.
Diane Swong, Chief Economist with Mesirow Financial, who's headed off to Jackson Hole later today. Thanks, Diane.
Thank you.
Well, if Bernanke does announce a new round of monetary stimulus tomorrow in Jackson Hole, it means he's more worried about deflation than inflation.
For that, let's bring in Marketplace Economics correspondent Chris Farrell to explain. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first, Chris, remind us what deflation is and why we're so concerned about it.
Inflation. That's what we're used to. Inflation is a rise in the overall price level. Deflation is a decline in the overall price level. Now, we've had a couple of brief episodes in recent history, but the real episode of deflation in our economy was the Great Depression, and that's why we worry about it.
Not really something we want to be comparing ourselves to right now.
No.
Well, Chris, I mean, are we really at risk of deflation again in 2011?
You know, if you look at the consumer price index, it's rising at a 3.6% annual rate. What's the problem, right? Prices are going up. We're still seeing inflation, but our economy is slowing down. Europe is slowing down. And if you look at the forward market-based indicators about inflation, they're telling us that the inflation rate is going to come down. So I think part of the debate that's going on here, Jeremy, is there's sort of the apocalypse soon crowd that keeps saying inflation, inflation, inflation. What inflation? And then there's another crowd, and I think this is the Bernanke Fed, or at least Dr. Bernanke, is concerned that the U.S. economy will become like Japan. It's sort of entering into a period of a deflationary sludge, two decades of slow growth, not a lot of job creation, and an ineffective monetary policy in dealing with deflation.
And is monetary policy what you use to deal with deflation, or is it something that requires some help from the fiscal side as well, from Congress?
Well, under normal conditions, you would do, Ben Bernanke used to be called Helicopter Ben because he was asked this question famously. And he said, look, if we have worry about deflation, we'll take helicopters and we'll just spread money all over the economy and that ends it. Now, that's in a normal environment. Well, that's not what's happening right now. Monetary policy right now is the only lever that we have. It can help. But boy, the best thing that could happen is to get the economy growing, to have an activist fiscal policy. And under those circumstances, guess what, Jeremy? We start worrying about inflation.
Simpler concerns. Marketplace economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Whole Foods will start offering wellness classes at some of its stores. Are you a Whole Foods shopper, Jeremy?
I occasionally, although it's here in L.A., it is a bit farther away from me than the other stores, so I really have to want something at Whole Foods to go there.
Well, maybe this will bring you in. So you can now join wellness classes at Whole Foods. And if you join, you can take classes in health and cooking. They have movie screenings and a supper club. There is some bad news, though. There's a catch. Club membership costs $750 a year.
That seems pretty expensive to me.
Well, I mean, it's Whole
Even
Foods.
For Whole Foods. Whole paycheck, as they call it.
That's like a cart full of groceries, the $750 at Whole Foods. The good news, though, is that members can come as they are. You know, the yoga pants that Whole Foods shoppers love to wear. Totally acceptable at all activities. Hurricane Irene is making a beeline for North Carolina. The storm is set to hit the coast Saturday, and it could pose the first big test for North Carolina's coastal insurance plan since it was reformed in 2009. Officials say they can pay up to $4 billion in damage, and after that, it's all on the homeowners. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has more.
Many homes and businesses on the North Carolina coast are covered by what's known as the Beach Plan. It's insurance of last resort for people who can't otherwise get coverage on their properties. The Beach Plan has about $70 billion in exposure. It has access to about $4 billion to pay out damages. Wayne Goodwin is the North Carolina Insurance Commissioner.
You may wonder, well, if there's $70 billion in exposures, is $4 billion enough?
Yeah, I wondered that.
Well, it would be because it is extremely unlikely that any single major storm or series of storms would devastate all of the exposures on the coast.
But if a storm did cause more than $4 billion in damages, under North Carolina law, homeowners across the state could be asked to pony up, paying as much as 10% more for their property insurance.
Then mine and my neighbors and the people in the rest of the state could have up to a 10% surcharge each year until that amount is paid off.
David Marlette is a professor at Appalachian State University, about 5 hours from the coast. He says adequately insuring beach properties is a struggle for all coastal states. Some plans are better funded and better thought out than others.
What kind of shape is North Carolina's plan in?
I would say compared to other states, it's pretty good.
Yes, Irene's track is ominous, but Marlette doesn't think it looks like the kind of storm that would overwhelm the $4 billion pool.
And let's hope that it doesn't get that bad.
I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
And finally, Stacey, the big earthquake this week on the East Coast. It didn't really have any victims, actually.
What about the Washington Monument?
And the National Cathedral in Washington. But we found another victim at the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., after the shaker. It was a piece of glass that was originally recovered from the control tower at the Seattle-Tacoma Airport after a 6.8 magnitude quake struck there back in 2001. And the control tower, most of the glass in the tower shattered, and they had to close the airport down and stop all these flights. But there was this one little piece that didn't break. And it was moved to be displayed at the National Air and Space Museum in Washington until Tuesday, when the 5.8 quake in Washington destroyed the
piece see,
of glass.
Jeremy, people, you West Coasters, you're making fun of that quake, but the piece of glass that survived the 6.8 quake in the West Coast went down.
One quake was enough for that one. It didn't want to go through
another
one.
Very traumatizing.
It moved to the East Coast to get away from that sort of thing.
I know the feeling.
Indeed. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson, which is no longer Quakeville, I guess. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Quake Central, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith. In New York, I'm in for Steve Chiatakis.
And this is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.